From the University of Alaska campus at College, this is Bob Olson with a weekly feature and news story from your state university. Future scholars will be indebted to a University of Alaska linguistics professor, Dr. Michael Krause, for research he is conducting on a nearly extinct language. Dr. Krause has been working with the survivors of the Iyak Indian tribe, which has a history of several thousand years. This tribe is the smallest and least known in Alaska, with fewer than 10 members left who can speak the Iyak language. They are elderly and only three are fluent. When Dr. Krause started his research in 1961, he immediately recognized the urgency of his task. Only 3 months before, he had arrived in South Central Alaska, where the Iyaks have lived, probably for 3,000 years. The last of those who spoke the language eloquently died in Cordova. She was Grandma Minnie Stevens. Dr. Krause has worked primarily with three natives who speak fluently: Mrs. Stevens' daughter Marie Smith, Lena Nactan, and Anna Nelson Harry. Mrs. Stevens wished to preserve her native tongue, so she taught Maria the language. Mrs. Nactan communicated regularly with her in Iyak. Dr. Krause, who came to Alaska as a Carnegie visiting professor, holds degrees from Harvard, Columbia, the Sorbonne, Chicago University, Western Reserve University, and the University of Iceland. He's among the few scholars familiar with Iyak who are qualified to analyze, transcribe, and devise an alphabet from the very complex sounds of the language. In 1961, the National Science Foundation awarded him a grant to chart the languages of Alaska, giving special priority to those near extinction. Alaska's main language groups are two, according to Dr. Krause: Eskimo Aleut and Nadine. Eskimo is divided into Inupic in the north and Yupik in the south. Approximately 12,000 natives can speak Yupik, from Prince William Sound to Norton Sound. About 4,000 have a knowledge of Inupic. They live in the Seward Peninsula and on the Arctic coast. The Aleut speakers live on the Aleutian chain and in the Pribilofs. Iyak, which is related to Athabascan and perhaps Tlingit and Haida of the Nadine group, is rapidly dying out. Native groups with a knowledge of their language are dwindling rapidly, Krause says. Parents have switched over to teaching English to their children. School teachers encourage the parents to teach their children English instead of their native tongue. 3,000 years ago, ancestors of the modern Athapascans and Iyaks were concentrated in an area of central Alaska and the Yukon, perhaps too small to support their needs. A small group of Iyaks, perhaps 100 or 150, left the area and made the difficult journey southward to the coast. There they settled around Cordova and Yakutat. Later, some of the Athapascans eventually scattered to southern Oregon, northern California, and even to the southwest United States, where they are known today as Navajos and Apaches. Russian adventurers discovered the Iyaks in the early 1800s, and the scholar diplomat aristocrat Retsinov was the first to document any of their language. He collected an interesting vocabulary in 1805, which was finally published in 1857. Two other small works collected by the Russian governors Wrangel and Furhelm were published in 1839 and 1872. Meanwhile, the United States purchased Alaska in 1867, but they lost track of much of what the Russians had learned about Alaska natives, and they completely lost track of the Iyaks. As a result, says Krause, we knew little about the Iyak. They were passed off simply as Tlingitized Eskimos. Well, the Iyaks were not discovered again as a separate tribe until 1930, when Frederica de Laguna, a noted American anthropologist, arrived in Prince William Sound to study the natives. These studies prompted an expedition in 1933 by a team of Danish and American explorers. In the next 28 years, only two linguists did any research on the Iyak language. But limited background material was only one of the problems Krause encountered. Other than Mrs. Smith, Mrs. Nactan, and Mrs. Harry, he has found only three natives who have some knowledge of Iyak. They are elderly natives who have not spoken much in 50 years. Thus, other than a few very old people in Yakutat who may remember a few words from their youth, these are the only survivors of the Iyaks. Dr. Krause hopes to preserve a complete vocabulary, grammar, and some native folklore texts. So, University of Alaska professor Dr. Michael Krause is working day and night to save what he can of the language and culture of this primitive Alaska race. And that's all for the week. This Is Your University is produced weekly by the Office of University Relations and recorded at University of Alaska radio station KUAC.
From the University of Alaska campus at college, this is Charles Northrup sitting in for Bob Olson with a weekly feature and news story from your state university. After years of Texan bragging, probably every Alaskan is familiar with the size of his state, 586,400 square miles, one-fifth the size of the rest of the U.S., with a coastline longer than any of the other states combined. In fact, as one wag recently pointed out, if Alaska were divided in half, Texas would suffer the ultimate indignity of becoming the nation's third largest state. Wildlife students at the University of Alaska don't make a habit of pointing this out to Texans, but in their quiet day-to-day routine of classroom lectures and research, they've probably become as well informed about Alaska's size and resource potential as anyone in the great land. In fact, the wildlife program at the university, with its emphasis on research in the state's huge expanse of virgin land that provides an ideal backyard workshop, has attracted international attention itself. About half of the 65 students enrolled this year come from outside of the state, ranging from the far reaches of Formosa to the warm state of Florida. Since it was started in 1951, the Department of Wildlife Management has shown rapid growth, primarily during the past decade under the direction of Dr. Frederick Dean, a graduate of the University of Maine and the State University of New York. Several graduate students studying biology, classifications, reproduction, and survival of fish throughout interior Alaska provide excellent testimony of the contribution to the state's welfare the department is making, while at the same time training future wildlife professionals. In the past 3 years, under the direction of Professor James Morrow, one of the top authorities on fish in the U.S., the students have explored nearly 600 miles of the Tanana and Yukon rivers and their tributaries, plus various other interior streams. Lloyd Chen of Taiwan and Kenneth Ault of Wisconsin placed traps, gill nets, and trammel nets at various points in the rivers from Fairbanks to Tetlin in the Tanana Basin and from Circle City to Eagle along the Yukon. The students use these standard sampling spots to analyze the water, take temperatures, note the weather, and survey the surrounding terrain and foliage to determine what type of fish there are in interior Alaska and why they're there. Samples of sheafish, burbot, Alaska blackfish, freshwater sculpin, and other species are collected and returned to the university laboratories to undergo tests. Another project, initiated by Dennis Kogel, a graduate student from California, studied the relation of water temperatures to the propagation and survival of fish in the Chena River. Still another student, Elder Shalluck, who came to the university from Wisconsin and is now employed by the Alaska Department of Fish and Game, researched the effect a power dam on the Chattanooga River had on the biology of fish. Besides providing the material for master's theses and articles for professional publications, the projects add to the basic knowledge of Alaska wildlife. "We are attempting to train fishery biologists," said Dr. Morrow, who spent 11 years at the Yale University Oceanographic Laboratory and has participated in several worldwide oceanographic expeditions. "The state needs people who understand the biology of fish with the goal of utilizing the fish resources of the state to its best possible advantage." Kogel's study, for instance, is expected to have practical application in the management of salmon fisheries, and the Fish and Wildlife Service feels it may contribute knowledge to the construction of a flood control dam on the Chena River. Another practical aspect of the wildlife program is a commercial fisheries course started in southeastern Alaska in 1961. Although he's based in Juneau, Professor Jack Doyle, a University of Washington graduate and commercial fisherman himself, roams southeastern and westward towns from Kodiak to Anchorage, teaching commercial fishermen the latest methods of their trade. The program is administered through the Division of Statewide Services. And that's all for this week. This Is Your University is produced weekly by the Office of University Relations and recorded at the University of Alaska's radio station, KUAC.
From the University of Alaska campus at College, this is Bob Olson with a weekly feature and news story from your state university. 300 miles north of the Arctic Circle at the most northern point in the United States lies Barrow, Alaska. It's a bustling Eskimo village on the Arctic Ocean. This largest Eskimo village in the world is the home of the University of Alaska's most northern permanent facility, the Arctic Research Laboratory. The laboratory, operated by the University for the U.S. Office of Naval Research since 1953, provides all facilities and services for fundamental research in scientific fields related to the Arctic environment. The past 2 weeks, the ARL has been the center of nationwide attention as scientists from the National Aeronautics and Space Administration prepared a Nike Cajun rocket. They were preparing it for firing from a site near the Arctic Research Laboratory. The university and the ARL has cooperated with NASA in the design and construction of the launch facilities. They presented special problems because of the climate and permafrost. A series of three rockets were scheduled to be fired in late January and in early February. Cooperation with NASA is but one of the laboratory's many scientific support functions, however. During the history of ARL, 28 different agencies and 56 colleges, universities, or other research institutions have enjoyed its facilities and services. About 600 individual scientists and technicians have been assisted, many of these returning intermittently or even annually. One of the laboratory's accomplishments, which has grasped the imagination of people around the world, is the establishment and support of research stations on floating ice islands. Out of four ice islands established, two of them are major facilities and are currently in use. T3, a venerable ice island originally occupied by the U.S. Air Force, has been under ARL support since 1962. It presently supports a marine biology research program in the Arctic Ocean. Ice Island Arliss 2 last week was 40 miles off the coast of Greenland, its path seemingly destined to lead it into the North Atlantic Ocean. Since its discovery by ARL Director Max Brewer in 1961, Arliss 2 has taken quite a journey. The huge cake of freshwater ice, which is about 1.5 miles wide and 3.5 miles long, has had passengers from the laboratory since it was 130 miles north of Point Barrow. Since 1961, it has moved in a zigzag course east across the Arctic Ocean. It came in close contact with the North Pole and twice crossed the international dateline. During this journey, it has served as a roving laboratory from which scientists from several nations have explored the climate, water, the ice, sea bottom, and other features of the Arctic Ocean. Supporting Arliss 2 and its passengers is no easy task. The 2,800-mile round trip from Barrow to Arliss takes about 22 hours flight time in a Navy R-4D aircraft, similar to a DC-3. The laboratory has made about 40 such trips each year since 1961. How long the now-inhabited island of ice has been floating around the Arctic Ocean is not known. Some scientists believe that it is the island sighted as early as 1909 by Admiral Peary when he made the first sledge trip to the North Pole. Or perhaps Arliss is the same island sighted and photographed by Eskimos off Point Barrow in 1931. Because of its rock-covered hills rising 40 feet above the surrounding ice floe, its mud, and even stunted vegetation, Arliss could easily be mistaken for a real island. The more than 20 scientists and support personnel on the island today will stick to Arliss on its voyage throughout the Greenland Sea. They're all full of enthusiasm, for little is known about the Greenland Sea, and little research has been accomplished there since a Russian-manned ice floe station crossed the Arctic Ocean and entered the sea in 1938. The people who operate the Arctic Research Laboratory are a dedicated group. They're enthusiastic about their history-making work. They have a staff of 10 in administration, 7 pilots and mechanics, 5 part-time office workers, and 30 other support and service personnel. 31 of ARL's staff members are Eskimos, handling such skilled jobs as equipment foremen, mechanics, welders, and teletype operators. Plans are now well along for the construction of a new modern laboratory complex to replace the temporary type structure now used. When completed in about 1967, it will give the University of Alaska and the Arctic Research Laboratory much greater capability to assist scientists and researchers from the entire world. And that's all for this week. This Is Your University is produced weekly by the Office of University Relations and recorded at University of Alaska radio station KUAC. From the University of Alaska campus at College, this is Bob Olson with a weekly feature story from your state university. An introduction to the University of Alaska is an introduction to this vast state which forms its campus. The university's teaching, research, and service projects reach 3,000 miles from Alaska's southern tip to floating ice islands in the Arctic Ocean and the Greenland Sea. In between are community colleges in 6 cities, research laboratories and experimental units in many other communities, and of course, hundreds of Alaskans who are obtaining education through evening classes, correspondence study, and special extension courses. The variety of activity and complexity of organization of Alaska's State University astounds the new student and the visitor, especially if his mental picture provides only for the professor and student in a typical classroom. The University of Alaska is much more. To an Eyak Indian near Cordova, the university is a professor who lived in his village to study his almost extinct language. To the adventuresome, it's a floating ice island in the Arctic Ocean, manned by university scientists. To a man on the remote Bering Sea island of St. Paul, the university is a monthly envelope containing the next correspondence lesson in American government. To a farmer in the Matanuska Valley, it's an agronomist with the Agricultural Experiment Station who has developed a new strain of hardy grass. To 42 students at the windswept Aleutian village of ADAC, it is a weekly class in accounting, American government, or international relations. To students from 41 states and 16 foreign countries, the University of Alaska is an opportunity to learn and learn well from a dedicated faculty. Constantly working to help make all Alaska the university's campus is the Division of Statewide Services. Its representatives take the university into many remote areas of the state, making education available to Alaskans who otherwise would not have the opportunity. The service department with the longest record is the Cooperative Extension Service in Agriculture and Home Economics. It was launched in 1930. Since then, many extension teachers feel most at home when living out of a suitcase. A bright-eyed, vivacious little grandmother, for instance, carries education to hundreds of Alaska's native people by bush plane and dog sled in the remote Seward Peninsula area. Mrs. Gladys Musgrove works out of Nome. She travels with pressure cookers and sewing machines and other equipment normally foreign to a teacher. Most of her work, however, she carries in her heart. Mrs. Musgrove works with 4-H Club leaders and members, teaching them how to lead meetings and to develop skills such as gardening and handicraft. She teaches Native women to can with pressure cookers and to sew with fabric instead of fur and leather. She brings self-confidence and leadership ability into the open. The Department of Evening Classes and Correspondence Study offers credit classes at many locations throughout the state that do not have community colleges. This department also serves the military personnel in Alaska. Evening classes are conducted on the main campus at college and as far away as ADAC in the Aleutian Islands. During the fall semester of 1964, 1,350 people enrolled in these classes. The Department of Summer Sessions, conferences and short courses offers traditional type courses and programs, as well as many which are designed to meet specific Alaska needs. An example is the 5-year pre-college orientation program for Alaska Natives started last year. It is designed to help Alaska Native high school graduates make the social and cultural adjustments to higher education in modern society. Mining extension, commercial fisheries extension, and civil defense education programs are also geared to the special needs and condition in Alaska for both professionals and amateurs. A Department of Audiovisual Communication serves the instructional needs of the university faculty and at the same time offers a statewide film and film strip service. It's available to schools, groups, and individuals in all parts of the state. Though almost continuous travel is normal routine for anyone in the Statewide Services Division, many instructors must be found in local areas. Surprisingly, this is not too difficult, even with the state's small population, because Alaska's educational level is extremely high. Alaska has the highest percentage of high school graduates of all the 50 states, and is second only to Utah in the percentage of school years completed by adults. It's the goal of the University of Alaska to maintain this high level of education for the 49th state. And that's all for this week. This Is Your University is produced weekly by the Office of University Relations and is recorded at University of Alaska radio station KUAC. From the University of Alaska campus at college, this is Bob Olson with a weekly feature story from your state university. To the average person, the truism that birds migrate south in the winter and north in the summer means one thing, that the birds must like the warmth of a more southerly climate. This isn't necessarily true of Alaska's state bird, the ptarmigan, however. When the ptarmigan migrates south annually, it considers the Koyukuk River, only 80 miles from the Arctic Circle, as its Miami Beach home for the winter. The Koyukuk area of Alaska's interior is often colder than the Arctic shores. The ptarmigan, A northern grouse that turns snow white in the winter is found in great numbers in Alaska's Arctic and subarctic. It is proving to be a most cooperative subject for the University of Alaska's Institute of Arctic Biology and its study of the animals and birds of the Northland. Its annual migration from the frozen shores of the Arctic Ocean to the interior of Alaska, a distance of only 500 miles, keeps the ptarmigan within the state's borders for easy study the year round. During the winter months, almost all of the ptarmigan's sustenance is obtained from the shoots, twigs, and buds of the willow bush. It is so selective in its diet that of the five species of willow available at times in winter, it almost exclusively favors one type. For the university's scientists, this simplifies their study of the nutrient value of the ptarmigan's unique diet. According to Dr. Lawrence Irving, director of the institute, the bird appears to get along better on its simple winter diet of willow browse than on its more diversified summer choices of insects and other types of green foliage. Study of the ptarmigan is only one of several projects underway at the institute since it was established in 1963. It is important, however, to the study of many other northern animals, such as moose, deer, beaver, and rabbit, which also feed on willow browse. These animals lead a more complicated life, which is difficult to keep under surveillance or to apply scientific measures to. The Institute's staff of eight scientists is dedicated to studies of life in the extreme climatic changes of Arctic and subarctic regions. The changing modern world makes Arctic research extremely important. Modern transportation, expanding populations, increased pressures on natural resources, and considerations of national security. These are but a few of the modern problems that give significance to knowledge of the Arctic. Alaska encompasses vast areas of land and water which lie within the Arctic. Research on biological problems of these cold regions contribute extensively to the knowledge which will permit man to live more successfully in the Arctic and to use its resources with greater wisdom in the future. One of the many interesting questions being explored is, how do animals adapt to the cold environment, and what can man learn from their adaptation? Research in this area is resulting in further knowledge of the radiator system built into all animals and human life, which permit discharging of heat through the hands and feet. Studies of Eskimo volunteers who have spent their lives in the Arctic snow, rather who have spent their lives in the Arctic, show that their bodies adjust to the cold and can endure exposure that would freeze the hands or feet of people raised in more southerly climates. Though the staff is always looking for new knowledge to aid man, currently most of the research is in the area of animal physiology. This is being carried out through the Institute's Laboratory of Zoophysiology. Plans are underway for additional laboratories in human ecology and plant physiology for more intensive study of man and of plants in the Arctic and subarctic environment. A new biological sciences building in the university's Arctic Research Center complex is now under construction. It will provide laboratories and other facilities for research and graduate instruction by the College of Biological Sciences and Renewable Resources and for the Institute of Arctic Biology. Development of the Arctic and subarctic depends on the knowledge man can gather about the environment of these climates, particularly the animal and plant life now existing in them. The University of Alaska's Institute of Arctic Biology is making a direct contribution to the scientific knowledge. And that's all for this week. This Is Your University is produced weekly by the Office of University Relations and recorded at University of Alaska radio station KUAC. From the University of Alaska campus at College, this is Bob Olson with a weekly feature story from your state university. Alaska's bond with Japan is being further strengthened through a new cooperative research program involving a common problem, volcanoes. The new program is one of two University of Alaska projects in connection with the United States and Japan Cooperative Scientific Program. The research is financed by a grant from the National Science Foundation and is under the guidance of the university's Geophysical and Marine Science Institutes. Basically, the scientists hope to gather more information about the geochemistry and petrology of volcanic rocks from seamounts in the Gulf of Alaska and in the interior regions of central and northwestern Alaska. The program also includes a study of volcanic gases from Mount Trident and from Mount Wrangell volcanoes. Principal investigators in the new project are Dr. Robert Forbes of the University of Alaska Geology Department and Geophysical Institute, and Dr. T. Katursa of the Tokyo Institute of Technology. Since last November, Two Japanese scientists have been working at the university alternately, laying the groundwork for field research next summer. In addition to being scientists, field researchers often need to be outdoorsmen. In this case, besides a scientific orientation, the field studies may require some mountaineering ability. Researchers plan to descend from the summits to the bases of Mount Wrangell and Mount Trident, collecting volcanic samples. They will begin the Wrangell project from a summit research station established at the 13,800-foot level. The research station may be the only one in the world heated by a reservoir of hot lava from a previous eruption. The station is a wooden structure, which was erected by a 6-man University of Alaska team last summer, supported by an Air Force helicopter team from the U.S. Army Arctic Test Center at Fort Wainwright. Mount Trident, about 6,000 feet in height, is located on the Alaska Peninsula. It is near Mount Katmai, which erupted violently in 1912, spewing volcanic ash into the stratosphere, darkening skies all over the world. Trident itself is regarded as the most active volcano in the Katmai National Monument. Because of the ever-present danger of eruption, the scientists are taking special precautions to alert them to any possible eruptions. On Mount Wrangell, for instance, Dr. Edward Berg of the University's Geophysical Institute and Department of Geology is supervising installation of a seismic warning system. It will monitor preliminary tremors, which usually precede an eruption. In addition, camps will be established down the side of the mountain to enhance a quick descent in the event helicopter support is not immediately available. In one aspect of the study, Dr. Forbes and his colleagues hope to shed more light on conflicting theories concerning what system of volcanoes Mount Wrangell belongs to. It was formerly believed that the volcano belonged to the Aleutian Arc system. But Dr. Forbes says that preliminary research indicates that Wrangell may be more closely related to the volcanoes of the Pacific Northwest, including Mountains Rainier, Balser, Adams, and St. Helens in Washington, and Mount Hood in Oregon. The scientists are investigating two major types of lava in relation to the problem. Basalt is a dark-colored, very fluid lava, which is believed to originate within the Earth's mantle. Andesite, a dark reddish-brown rock, which is dominantly erupted by Pacific Rim volcanoes, is believed may be derived from basalt, which has been contaminated by material from the Earth's crust during its ascent to the surface. Some volcanoes defy this theory, however. In the western part of the Aleutian Arc, volcanoes erupt andesite, but there appears to be no continental crust. As important to the scientific aspects of the U.S.-Japanese effort are, Dr. Forbes is equally concerned with the increased understanding and friendship the cooperation of the two countries might bring. He has been associated personally with the Japanese since he was a member of the Army of Occupation following World War II. He returned again in 1954 as a researcher for the Department of Defense. In 1962, he attended the International Symposium on Volcanology in Japan, and in addition to that, he spent a year studying there in 1963 and 1964. Speaking in a scientific sense, but also referring to the cultural aspects, Dr. Forbes believes there should be continuing interchange between Alaska and Japan. After all, he says, we are both Pacific Rim peoples. And that's all for this week. This Is Your University is produced weekly by the University of Alaska, the Office of University Relations. It is recorded at University Radio Station KUAC. From the University of Alaska campus at College, this is Bob Olson with a weekly feature story from your state university. Russian scientists are now carrying out experiments set up by a University of Alaska professor in a spirit of warm cooperation at the coldest spot on Earth. Dr. Victor Hessler, professor of geophysics at the university's Geophysical Institute, recently returned to the campus after working 3 weeks at the Russian research station Vostok in the Antarctic. The trip resulted in much more than scientific dividends for Dr. Hessler, who is one of the world's top authorities on the aurora. I feel I've gained 14 new friends, he said, and I believe they feel they have a new American friend. Dr. Hessler was referring to the 13 Russians and one Czechoslovakian who operate the station. Deep within the Antarctic continent, Vostok is high on the South Polar Ice Plateau, about 750 miles from the South Pole. It is at the core of the Earth's magnetic field, a key position for studies of geomagnetism and related mysteries of the polar skies. Upper atmospheric physicists attempt to solve such age-old mysteries as the causes of the northern lights and of magnetic storms when compass needles swing erratically, and such newer mysteries as the cause of radio blackouts, cosmic rays, Whistler radio noises, radiation belts, and solar flares. Scientists can study all these related phenomena through their accompanying effects on the magnetosphere. That's the magnetic field surrounding the Earth, or on the ionosphere, or on both. Dr. Hessler, for example, is studying the quiverings of the magnetosphere known as micropulsations, using instruments with metal coils in which the vibrating magnetic field causes small but measurable currents. Scientists think that micropulsations are caused by ionospheric electric currents, which in turn are produced by solar particle streams. Dr. Hessler went to the station to install scientific equipment for measuring micropulsations. In a spirit of international cooperation, the Russians are operating the American equipment, with each nation receiving identical copies of the scientific data. A similar station operated by Americans at Thule, Greenland, is also recording data for Dr. Hessler's study, as well as for Russian scientists. Dr. Hessler's trip to Antarctica began in mid-November when he flew to Hawaii, the Fiji Islands, and Christchurch, New Zealand, the jumping-off point for Antarctica expeditions. From there, he was flown to Cape Hallett, then to McMurdo Station, headquarters for U.S. Antarctic research operations. Then he took side trips to Byrd Station and Amundsen Scott, the South Pole station at the very bottom of the world. Amundsen Scott, at 9,200 feet above sea level, served as an altitude adaptation stopover for Vostok, which is 2¼ miles above sea level. At Vostok, he joined another Alaskan, John Jacobs, a 25-year-old University of Alaska graduate student who has been spending a year at the station as part of an annual exchange of scientists between the U.S. and Russia. The first American to work at Vostok, Jacobs was investigating radio signals generated naturally in the Earth's magnetic field and was maintaining the Vostok line of a continental network of forward scatter radio equipment. The temperature at Vostok during Dr. Hessler's visit was warm for the area, ranging from minus 30 to minus 40 degrees. The coldest temperature recorded there was a minus 127 degrees in August of 1960. Of the Russians, only the station doctor spoke English. He learned the language from Jacobs and was teaching Jacobs Russian. The Czech, fluent in both languages, was interpreter. One of the highlights of the trip, Dr. Hessler remembers, was a party to celebrate four birthdays, at which the camp leader proposed a toast to further scientific cooperation between America and Russia. While Hessler was at Vostok, the flags of the United States, Russia, and Czechoslovakia flew together over the main building. Dr. Hessler left the campus again Friday for Barrow, Alaska, en route to a new drifting research station in the Arctic Ocean, about 150 miles northeast of Point Barrow. He will remain on the ice floe for about 6 weeks. And that's it for this week. This Is Your University is produced by the Office of University Relations at the University of Alaska and is recorded at University Radio Station, KUAC. From the University of Alaska campus at College, this is Bob Olson with a weekly feature story from your state university. Automation is a frightening word to some people. To others, it symbolizes much that is good in their lives. It also symbolizes a great many problems which will face Alaskans in years to come. This week, and for the next 3 weeks, we will discuss automation and related factors and their challenge to education in the United States, and especially in Alaska. Never has a period of history had greater significance for man's future than the past two decades. The explosive population changes and phenomenal advances in technology and automation since World War II have such far-reaching consequences that it is almost beyond imagination or understanding. Their impact on education is massive. It may not be fully comprehended for years. Their impact on Alaska, already with its share of growing pains, will be tremendous. The growth of automation and technology is the surging force of our age, a phenomenon without parallel in history. It is much greater in scope and meaning than the Industrial Revolution was. Coupled with the tremendous population increase, they create complex and urgent problems whose solution seems to be centered in education. Unemployment, underemployment, high school and college dropouts, displaced workers, retraining of workers with obsolete skills, threats to traditions and ways of life. Our youth, the nation's greatest resource, entering a world changing so rapidly it seems to have no place for them. These are not mere conjectures of what might happen in the future. These are present-day realities. To our nation's educators, the problems present a dramatic challenge that must be met with immediate action to avoid lasting damage to the economy and social structure of the country. Four distinct complex problems facing higher education today stem from the increased population and technology. First, the new technology has fashioned great changes in man's relationship to his work and his education. For the first time in history, man's education stands directly between him and his occupational goals. The traditional point of entry to the work world, starting at the bottom and earning while learning, has been closed. No longer is there room at the bottom of the labor market for people without specific skills and knowledge obtained through education on the semi-professional, technical, and skilled levels. Sufficient technological and occupational education is an urgent need if we are to avoid society's disaster gap, that educational void between high school graduates and university graduates. The second problem is the population explosion. It has created a vast core of college-age youth, along with new social pressures causing the assumption that a college education is mandatory. The result is a serious crisis in higher education. In state after state, public universities are turning away thousands of qualified students. The old idea that every high school graduate has the open opportunity to attend a public institution of higher education no longer stands. Entry requirements are becoming more stringent every year. Tens of thousands of qualified students are turned away. There simply is not room for them. The third problem is re-education. Re-education and continuing education is a present and rapidly growing need. Adult education, as traditionally known, must be greatly broadened and modified. The pace of change is so swift, the growth of new knowledge so enormous, that much of what is being taught today soon will be obsolete. Much yet undiscovered will have to be learned. Professional and technical people must continually upgrade their information and skills as a routine course of action. Many youngsters starting out today will have to relearn their vocations at least three times during their careers just to keep up. The word for each of us who works is continue to learn or else. The fourth problem is the increase of leisure time. This brings another challenge to education. Technology and automation will, in the next few years, justify the workday reduction in many occupations to 4 or 5 hours. This expanded leisure time will demand new approaches to the use of time and new attitudes toward the concept of work and free time. These complex problems and their many side effects have created a crisis that is revolutionizing the philosophy and approach to higher education. It's a crisis which will get worse before it gets better. Alaska, because of its size, location, and relationship to other states, will soon be affected by these problems. But these same peculiarities afford us an opportunity to prepare to meet the problems without crisis. And that's it for this week. This Is Your University is produced weekly by the Office of University Relations at the University of Alaska and recorded by University Radio Station KUAC.